Today is Wednesday, May 19th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganya in Washington. I'm in for Steve Miller. The death toll continues to rise in the fighting between Israel and Hamas militias in Gaza. The UN says that hundreds of thousands in Gaza face shortages of clean water and medicine.
In total, an estimated 800,000 people are lacking regular access to safe water. The need for food and cash support is also increasing.
Jordan's prime minister says that his country may expel the Israeli prime minister after parliament issued the call due to escalating violence between Israelis and Palestinians.
King Abdullah has been saying for 20 years that the failure to address the root cause of the Israeli-Palestinian-Israeli Arab conflict will sooner or later result in explosions.
We'll have these stories and more coming up right here. International Edition. Our top story today, the death toll continues to rise in the fighting between Israel and Hamas militias in Gaza. More than 200 Palestinians have died under Israeli airstrikes and more than 1,400 have been injured, many of them children. Israel reports more than 12 people have died in its territory from Hamas rockets. The fighting, now in its second week, is the worst since 2014, and has set off a flurry of diplomatic efforts to restore calm. The United Nations Security Council again met for a private session to seek a way to establish a ceasefire. The Associated Press reports that the Palestinian ambassador to the United Nations is calling on U.S. President Joe Biden's administration to show results from its efforts to achieve a ceasefire. Riyad Mansour said that the U.S. repeatedly blocks U.N. Security Council action on grounds that it would interfere with its diplomatic efforts, but there has been no ceasefire. More than 52,000 Palestinians have been displaced by Israel airstrikes that have destroyed or badly damaged nearly 450 buildings in the Gaza Strip, that is according to a U.N. aid agency. UN agencies say conditions in Gaza continue to deteriorate 9 days into the Israeli-Palestinian crisis. In Gaza, 200 people reportedly have been killed and more than 6,000 injured. 20 people have been killed in the West Bank, and the Palestinian rocket attacks in two populated areas of Israel reportedly have killed 12 people and injured 800. Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs says it welcomes the decision by Israeli authorities to open the Kerem Shalom border crossing, allowing essential humanitarian supplies to enter Gaza. It urges Israel also to open the Erez crossing so critical humanitarian staff can move in and out of Palestinian territory. Ocha says days of intense fighting and the destruction and damage to hundreds of buildings and houses has displaced nearly 47,000 people in Gaza. They reportedly have sought refuge in 58 schools run by UNRWA, the UN Relief and Works Agency. OCHA spokesman Jens Laerke says the North Gaza seawater desalination plant is still not operational, depriving 250,000 people access to drinking water.
In total, an estimated 800,000 people are lacking regular access to safe water. The need for food and cash support is also increasing. All fishing activity remains prohibited off the Gaza coast. As far as the security situation allows, the United Nations, along with our humanitarian partners, are providing food and non-food items to displaced families in Gaza and immediate cash assistance to more than 52,000 people.
Since the start of Ramadan, the World Health Organization has recorded 91 attacks on health facilities in Gaza and the West Bank, including East Jerusalem. It says 19 health facilities have been damaged in the Gaza Strip, including 6 hospitals and 9 primary health care centers. WHO spokeswoman Margaret Harris says Gaza only has 46% of essential drugs and 33% of essential medical supplies in stock. That is less than a one-month supply needed to treat the sick and injured.
The damage to the water infrastructure, including the wastewater networks and North Gaza seawater desalination plant is affecting public health measures that needed during COVID-19, but also the risk of waterborne diseases. And as you know, during COVID-19, one of the things that you need to do is avoid mass gatherings, avoid crowding.
Harris notes that is impossible given the tens of thousands of displaced people seeking refuge in overcrowded school facilities. She says the WHO needs $11 million to mount an urgent health response in the coming 3 months. Laerke tells VOA that OCHA has received no response or pushback from Israeli authorities regarding its assessment of conditions in Gaza. VOA calls to Israeli authorities on the subject have gone unanswered. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Jordan's Prime Minister Bishar al-Kassouni says his country may expel the Israel ambassador after Parliament issued the call due to escalating violence between Israelis and Palestinians. King Abdullah II is conducting intense diplomacy to try to stop the dangerous escalation amid concerns observers suggest should the crisis prompt another wave of Palestinian refugees into Jordan. In talks with his Jordanian counterpart, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken say that both Israelis and Palestinians equally deserve to live in safety and security. Del Gavlak reports from Amman.
Jordan has a 1994 peace treaty with Israel, and for years it has also been the chief supporter of Palestinian statehood. Public anger in the country, where Palestinian refugees and their descendants make up more than half of its 10 million population, is now boiling over. Large angry demonstrations here demand an end to forced evictions of Palestinian families in Jerusalem and deadly bombardment in Gaza. Bruce Riddell, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, says King Abdullah is correct when he has repeatedly warned that the lack of a just solution to the Palestinian problem would lead to the explosion of the situation in the region.
King Abdullah has been saying for 20 years that failure to address the root cause of the Israeli-Arab conflict will sooner or later result in explosions. As we've seen, the Jordanian position has always been that the world community, and the United States in particular, needs to put pressure on Israel to create a Palestinian state with its capital in East Jerusalem to represent the homeland for the Palestinian people.
Jordanian officials have expressed concerns about any spillover of violence in Israel and the Palestinian territories that could lead to another mass migration of Palestinians into Jordan after the 1948 and 1967 refugee waves, although Riddell doesn't necessarily see this happening. What's more worrisome is violence between Israeli Jews and Israeli Arabs.
They also do fear refugee flows. On the other hand, two previous intifadas in the West Bank, 1988 and 2000, this did not produce significant flows of refugees. It's a concern, but it's not an inevitability by any means. What's particularly dangerous about this situation, and largely unprecedented, is that we see these mobs and vigilantes on both sides, but especially on the Israeli side, attacking Israeli Arabs. The social contract between Israeli Jews and Israeli Arabs is coming apart. That augurs very poorly for the future of Israel.
Palestinian journalist Daoud Kotob, writing in a Los Angeles Times op-ed piece, urged Israel and the Palestinians, including Hamas, to talk. At this point, the idea of deterring conflict has become elusive because of the absence of a serious negotiation process, he said. Short of surrender, no conflict in the world can be solved by military means. Any resolution depends on negotiations, and naturally that means talking with your enemies, not your friends, Kotab said. With diplomatic efforts so far unable to stop the violence, the top U.S. military officer, Army General Mark Milley, warned that the violence could risk broader destabilization. Dale Gavlak for VOA News, Amman.
Following a lull in arrivals of migrants in Italy due to the pandemic, hundreds have now resumed risking their lives in search for a better future in Europe. As weather conditions improve and with the easing of COVID-19 restrictions in Italy, traffickers are taking advantage and overcrowding vessels with migrants from the Libyan coastline. For VOA, Sabina Castafranco reports from Rome.
Rescue missions to save hundreds of migrants have resumed in the Mediterranean waters between Libya and the small Italian island of Lampedusa, as calm seas and warmer temperatures have seen a significant rise in vessels attempting to make the crossing. Human traffickers are also taking advantage of a drop in COVID-19 infections and lifting of restrictions to travel between regions in Italy. The improving situation is raising concerns that the surge in migrant crossings will continue during the summer. Aid workers aboard the German charity ship CI4, which began its first mission to help migrants in distress at the beginning of this month, say the vessel has already rescued more than 400 people. They are calling on EU officials to give the ship access to a safe port. A spokesman on board the ship, Sophie Weidenhiller, says the migrants were from different African nations, some from Syria and Bangladesh, and were rescued in various operations. In one case, it reached a boat after receiving a distress call, but instead of finding the expected 50 migrants on board, it found the boat empty. Many migrants are attempting the crossing in vessels that are deemed far from seaworthy.
Less than 72 hours, our crew was able to rescue more than 400 people out of distress at sea. Among them, we have pregnant women, we have children, we have babies, we have many unaccompanied minors, and everybody aboard here is exhausted. And that is why we need a port of safety as soon as possible, so we can bring those people who have suffered so much to safety.
The German charity has warned that the crew is nearing the limit of their capacity to care for its migrant passengers. It is still awaiting a response from the EU on its request for permission to dock as it heads towards Italy. Malta refused it entry to its port. Commenting on the matter following the Maltese decision, Matteo Salvini, head of Italy's right-wing League party, said his country has a duty to defend its borders. The latest rescues come a week after more than 2,000 migrants landed on Lampedusa, overwhelming its reception center, which was then emptied so as to make space for new arrivals. Migrants have continued to arrive on the island. The Libyan Coast Guard has also been intercepting vessels and returning the migrants. UN and other agencies have said that over the past week they managed to take 1,000 migrants back to Libya. International Organization for Migration spokesman in Libya, Safam Zeli, said it provides support to the Libyan Coast Guard on the condition that no one is arbitrarily detained or otherwise subjected to human rights violations. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
U.S. President Joe Biden went to Michigan today to push for his infrastructure legislative plan, which has a heavy focus on mitigating climate change. VOA's White House Bureau Steve Hammond tells my colleague Kate Pound-Dawson that while Biden's plan is winning support among American voters, it still has some opposition in Congress.
Well, the president's been touring, visiting a number of states in recent weeks to promote his various ambitious legislative packages. And one part of all this is promotion of electric vehicles. So he went to a Ford facility in Dearborn, Michigan, where on Wednesday, the automaker is going to roll out its all-electric version of the F-150 pickup truck, which is its best-selling truck in that category. And after making some remarks following a tour of the plant, the president then actually got to test drive the new truck and proclaimed it to be very fast.
The president and his team have spent a lot of time selling his infrastructure plan to American voters. Is the perception among political analysts that he's succeeding at this or not, at least in wooing voters?
Well, there does seem to be, in general, a pretty decent public support for this. But what is really key is he going to get a requisite number of opposition party Republican lawmakers to sign on to any of this? or are there going to be compromises? And it appears most certainly we are going to see some compromises, which the president and the White House have said that they're open to. Electric vehicles is one part of that. There are some Republicans who have objected to the package more in general. Mitch McConnell last month, for example, said that the total funding that would be directed to roads, bridges, ports, waterways, and airports combined adds up to less than what it would spend on electric cars. So there's a lot of grumbling among Republicans about what should be the priorities here. They, in general, have criticized the president and the Democrats for going way beyond infrastructure and trying to put something together and get something passed that resembles more of the so-called Green New Deal, which progressives in the Democratic Party have been pushing, which includes all sorts of goals like universal health care and affordable housing, good paying jobs, and stronger labor rights. And Biden has taken some of that and put that in his legislative proposals, but some of this is still too much for the Republicans.
The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says that the United States administered COVID-19 vaccinations to around 600,000 children ages 12 to 15 last week after regulators cleared Pfizer Inc.'s and BioNTech shots for use in that age group. Reuters' Chris Dingham has more.
The past week has been a big week.
The White House COVID-19 response team announced on Tuesday that since regulators cleared the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine for 12 to 15-year-olds, around 600,000 in that age group have been vaccinated, in what CDC Director Rochelle Walensky has said is an important step for getting children back into schools and off to summer camps safely.
In less than 1 week, we have vaccinated more than 600,000 12 to 15-year-olds. And in total, more than 4.1 million adolescents aged 12 to 17 have been vaccinated so far. My own son was one of them.
The nation's top infectious disease expert, Anthony Fauci, said he expects the U.S. will have enough safety data to vaccinate children of any age by the end of 2021.
We will have enough information regarding safety and immunogenicity to be able to vaccinate children of any age.
The FDA authorized Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine for use in children as young as 12 last week. Most states began issuing shots to children last Thursday, but some, including Georgia, started sooner.
Lower-risk groups are now being vaccinated.
On Friday, the World Health Organization urged rich countries to reconsider plans to vaccinate children and instead donate COVID-19 shots to poorer countries, saying the second year of the pandemic was set to be more deadly than the first, with India being a huge concern.
I understand why some countries want to vaccinate their children and adolescents, but right now I urge them to reconsider and to instead donate vaccines to COVAX.
At Tuesday's briefing, Fauci said the existing COVID-19 shots probably also protect against the new variant of the coronavirus first found in India, which has been battling the world's biggest jump in coronavirus infections.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. Thousands of would-be migrants have crossed from Morocco into the Spanish enclave Ceuta in the past 2 days, setting off diplomatic spat between Madrid and Rabat. The European Union has gotten involved.
It is worrying that at least 6,000 people, a big number of them children, have been swimming to Ceuta, putting their life in danger. Many had to be rescued. One person died.
That was the EU Commission for Home Affairs, Eva Johansson, who told the European Parliament the sudden flood of migrants was unprecedented. A powerful cyclone slammed into western India over the past 24 hours, leaving at least 33 people dead. More than 90 were reported missing on Tuesday. The damage from Cyclone Tauktae compounds the country's woes as it posted a new record number of coronavirus deaths in 24 hours. The storm left hundreds of thousands of people without power after the storm hit the Gujarat coast of western India on Monday, with winds gusting up to 130 kilometers per hour. Prime Minister Narendra Modi is expected to visit the cyclone-hit regions in Gujarat, his home state, on Wednesday. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. An experiment at the U.S. Department of Energy's Fermilab in suburban Chicago is yielding results that could change the understanding of particle physics and what is known as the Standard Model. VOA's Ken Farabaugh spoke to scientists working on the project about ongoing research reshaping how they categorize the unseen quote-unquote forces that make up the basic building blocks of all matter and life.
For decades, the so-called Standard Model in physics has been the gold standard outlining what scientists know about the basic subatomic building blocks of everything known to man. Over the years, they have identified 17 fundamental particles and three forces.
It's the electromagnetic force, the weak force, which is connected to nuclear decay, and then also the strong force, which is what basically holds, you know, your protons and your neutrons inside of the nucleus and basically makes everything that we are, the structure that we are.
Renee Fatemi is a professor of physics at the University of Kentucky and is part of an international team at Fermilab outside Chicago. Partnering with the European Organization for Nuclear Research, or CERN, in Switzerland, the team is trying to unlock the subatomic secrets of the universe.
There's always this force, and it's a question of tapping into it. We're trying to figure out the new forces and particles.
An experiment at Fermilab aims to tap into the unknown. Of particular interest is the muon, one of 17 particles similar to an electron, a byproduct of cosmic rays. Muons constantly blanket Earth's surface. Fermilab used a specially designed 14-meter circular magnetic track to study how muons move through space. Data from billions of tests are challenging fundamental principles of the Standard Model known to generations of physicists.
We got a real hint, a real possibility that there could be a breakdown of all the fundamental things that we thought we knew.
Marcela Carena, head of theoretical physics at Fermilab, says the experiment is detecting phenomena that cannot be explained by the model that physicists constructed in the 1970s and updated as recently as 2012. Specifically, some unknown force or particle is interacting with muons in ways not predicted by the Standard Model. So, what exactly is it? Carena says data collected at Fermilab could hold the answer. Analysis has only just begun, but hints at the possibility of a major discovery.
There could be one or more particles that are starting to talk with the muon.
I knew that this result could be possibly a watershed moment for physicists. I mean, it's like finally now we have a hint of where to go next.
The particle breakthrough has led to a surge of interest in Fatemi's work.
Talking about muons and standard models, I mean, nobody talks about that over dinner, right? But hey, now they do, and that's super cool.
While Fermilab's muon experiment continues, Marcela Carena says the next phase of research could yield more clues by smashing or colliding the particles together. Doing that might require more advanced technology than Fermilab's accelerator or even the Large Hadron Collider at CERN's facility in Europe. Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Batavia, Illinois.
When Americans think of coffee culture, they often think of Seattle, the home of Starbucks. But some say New York City may have a better claim as the U.S. center of coffee. Nina Vishneva examined that part of the city's history in this story narrated by Anne Rice.
As in any large metropolis, mornings in New York City start like this.
Snow coffee and one bagel, please.
They come to work rain or shine and are always welcomed by busy New Yorkers, the food cart vendors. $2 will buy you a breakfast. Another popular morning destination is the deli, short for delicatessen, usually a small store that has everything one might need. A small snack selection, some hot food, and the obligatory coffee to go.
We've had a lot of famous people come in. All these people have come in. Sylvester Stallone and Howard Stern is a customer, but he doesn't drink the coffee.
Coffee first came to New York in the early 1600s, back when the city was called New Amsterdam by its Dutch founders.
New York City was really the coffee capital of North America. And the coffee culture of New York City is very distinct because it was a Dutch colony.
By the 1800s, stores would sell steaming hot cups of coffee for a few cents. Local rumors and news came for free. Once paper cups made their entrance, coffee to go became a morning routine.
We provide is an excellent cup of freshly roasted coffee every single day for 100 years.
Alexandra Vassilaris is the owner of a coffee empire. For three generations, her company has been giving New Yorkers what they need most in the mornings. Since the 1960s, many New York coffee shop owners have been immigrants from Greece. So it's not accidental that one of the most recognizable coffee cup symbols here is an amphora. Like yellow taxicabs, they were a symbol for coffee to go. But then Starbucks came along. For Nina Vishnyova in New York, Anna Rice, VOA News.
The new U.S. representative to the United Nations, longtime Africa specialist Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield, laid out the Biden administration's policy on Africa ahead of a U.N. Security Council meeting on the topic on Wednesday. She also noted that she is working behind the scenes with African nations on the Security Council to address the current conflict between Israel and Hamas. VOA's Anita Powell reports.
The new U.S. representative of the United Nations says she doesn't see the African continent as a challenge, but rather as a home away from home. That's the attitude that U.S. Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield, who forged her diplomatic career on this continent, says she plans to take into a key U.N. Security Council meeting this week about challenges facing the vast continent. Those include violent insurgencies in places like Mozambique and the Sahel region, conflict in Ethiopia, economic destruction from the pandemic, and more.
We're committed to being a partner to Africa as you confront these threats and these challenges. And we believe that the best and the strongest partnerships are built on a foundation of trust and transparency and accountability and areas of mutual opportunity.
Such warm words are a departure from what Thomas-Greenfield acknowledged were a frosty 4 years between the Trump administration and the continent. The career diplomat has represented the U.S. in Kenya, Gambia, Nigeria, Liberia, and as President Barack Obama's Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. Now, as representative to the U.N., she's bringing the Biden administration's Africa policy to the global stage during Wednesday's meeting. Thomas-Greenfield acknowledged the goal is not the work of one meeting or even one country, and singled out another country with vast outreach to Africa.
The United States can't do it alone. We have to do it in consultation and support of the African people, and we do it for the African people. I would say that it worries me as I look at Africa's relationship with China, for example, that is a relationship that sometimes rests on coerciveness, indebtedness, and not in partnership. And I want our message to be completely the opposite of that.
VOA asked the ambassador about increasing hostilities between Israel and Hamas. 10 of the 22 members of the Arab League are African states, and that body has harshly criticized Israel's recent military actions in Gaza. The U.S. blocked a U.N. Security Council statement calling for a ceasefire amid the violence, with U.S. officials saying they prefer quiet, intensive diplomacy to solve the problem. Thomas-Greenfield said the administration is pushing for a peaceful solution on multiple fronts.
We are engaging with Africans on this issue, both at the Security Council and across the board. We have taken intense diplomatic efforts to try to find a solution to this situation from the most senior levels of the United States. As you've seen in the press, President Biden has engaged several times with President Netanyahu. Secretary Blinken has engaged with government officials, and I have engaged with the government, as well as other parties here in New York, to push for a solution. And again, that includes members from Africa.
The 15-member Security Council, which currently contains Kenya, Niger, and Tunisia as non-permanent members, meets Wednesday. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Jackson Vunganya in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.